Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
yeah, we did. We started to burn too many things we found. That's the magnificent Dar Williams singing with Pete Seeger and David Burns, my buddies here to start the Solartopia Green Power Show. Once again, we have a fabulous guest going to be with us the full hour, Charles Komaroff, someone I've known since the 1970s, although he doesn't look a day over 25. We're going to be talking full range here. We're going to go the full Monty on the election. Tonight is the Hillary Clinton's big speech at the Democratic Convention. And we're going to talk about the race between Mussolini and Margaret Thatcher. That's basically what we're down to. And it's a tough choice for us Americans here in 2016. But Charlie is also the great expert on the carbon tax and economics of energy in general. And, of course, we'll be talking about nuclear power. We're also going to talk, Charlie is one of the pioneers in bike commuting. If you have ridden a bike in New York City, you owe a great debt to Charles Komaroff. He's been doing this for decades. So we have a full hour. We're just going to go straight, flat out, and it will fly by, as it always does when I have someone so brilliant and exciting as Charlie Komaroff. Charlie, say hi to us, please, if you would.
Hey, Harvey. Wow. Thanks for the lovely intro.
Well, listen, Charles, you're in New York, and I am in L.A. I got to warn you, by the way, at the top of the hour, that last week my phone kicked out a number of times. I have no idea why. So if I disappear from the line, I will be calling back. And, Charlie, you can continue to talk. Please do. It's just one of those things, who knows why. Hopefully it won't happen this week, but the crew in New York is on top of it, and we will continue in this land of the cell phone to do our radio shows with things that aren't plugged in. Charlie, let's start. First of all, tell us, Charlie, what you work on these days, where people are going to find you, and a few of your fantastic credentials.
Well, the main thing is the carbon tax. And, yeah, we're going to spend some time this hour talking about it. People can go to carbontax.org. Or you can just Google carbon tax. The organization is the Carbon Tax Center. And we are the ones that are doing the numbers and some political analysis and rabble-rousing on behalf of an economy-wide, comprehensive, fair, and kind of fundamental carbon tax that makes the polluters pay for carbon pollution and corrects the market failure that allows polluters, people who burn fossil fuels and emit carbon dioxide, to use the atmosphere as their dumping ground and not have to pay a price for it. And it's our belief that a robust carbon tax, one that starts at a kind of moderate level so we don't knock people over with really higher energy prices overnight, but that we phase it in or ramp it up, can really do the job or be the mainstay of the job of transitioning the economy from dirty energy to clean energy. So that's my main thing. I'm working on some traffic pricing or congestion pricing ideas for New York City as a way to cut down on automobile craziness and create a new revenue stream for mass transit. And as ever, I still have a hand in on pedestrian and bicyclist activism to push back against the hegemony of the automobile.
Well, that's fantastic. So you talked about two of the biggest issues that we're all facing, carbon and transportation. I have ridden a bicycle around New York City, and every time I do, I think of you. Last time I was there, actually, I rented one of those city bikes, and we'll talk about that program in a little bit later in the show. Charlie, you've written a ton of stuff. What do you recommend people read to know your work?
Wow, it really depends on what folks are interested in. If you go to my own personal website, which is Komanoff.net, and maybe we should spell that name, Komanoff, it's like Romanoff, but with a K, so it's K-O-M-A-N-O-F-F. Those last two letters are like fast food or foot fetish, you know, F-F. Komanoff.net, and you can go to pages on, reclaiming the streets for walking and biking, traffic pricing, carbon taxing, the disaster that is fossil fuels, the economic catastrophe that has been and continues to be nuclear power, and even a little bit of stuff about, you know, music, stuff about noise pollution, which I've measured and written about. So, you know, whatever your interest is, anything that has to do with quantifying environmental damages and trying to look at economics in a way that is progressive, not market-based, I hate that expression, but something that corrects market failures in the service of environmental sustainability and economic equity. I guess I've been involved in that for a long time, and a lot of that stuff is at Komanoff.net.
Beautiful. All right, so having touched on not one thing that we're about to talk about, let's talk about Hillary Clinton and the election that's upon us, and we'll come back then to the carbon tax, and after that to bicycling and transportation, and we'll maybe finish up with a little wrap on music. But tonight, Hillary Clinton will address the world as the first female nominee of a major party in United States history for the office of President of the United States. It is a grueling, difficult, painful election process, but boy, I have to say it is really fascinating. This is as interesting an election as any of us have ever been involved in. You go back to, you know, Bush v. Gore, Kerry v. whoever that was, Bush again, the two Obama elections. You know, they were pretty interesting. This one is just absolutely fascinatingly spectacular and terrifying, of course. As I said, I characterize it as Mussolini versus Margaret Thatcher. Charlie, we had some conversation before. Your views are fascinating. What do you think? Tell us your opinion on what's happening in this election.
Oh man, I'm totally with you, Harvey, that this is riveting. It's fascinating, and I guess the thing that is gripping above all is, how is it that a significant percentage of the polled electorate is saying now that they would vote for Trump? And, you know, we can slice that a million different ways, and yet it is fundamentally disturbing, not only because there's a possibility that, you know, Trump could become the next president, but what it signifies about our democracy, our media, our culture, the left out feeling that so many, let's say it straight up, white people seem to be feeling or nursing or indulging in, how that has all come about. You know, we've kind of got a sense of it, and yet it still is amazing that people have so far been conned by this guy who is a charlatan, a crook, a bully, and a narcissist. And, you know, we can only hope that in the remaining 100 days or whatever it is that the cover gets ripped off this guy, Donald Trump, and that enough people in the electorate come to their senses that we not only defeat him in November, but that he and the nativist, racist, and self-centered movement that he represents is repudiated so that it doesn't have a ghost of a chance of coming back, for a century, if ever. And let's also hope that the coattails of that repudiation could be strong enough that the Democrats could run the table and create not just a Democratic Senate, but a Democratic House, next year, so that we really have a chance to advance a progressive agenda. So, that's what's at stake. That's what's fascinating, and you and I should probably talk about what might be our differing voting strategies for November 8th.
Yeah, well, there are a number of options out there. I have to say that I agree with everything you said, but I have to say that I think that one of the reasons that Trump has been a successful candidate so far has nothing to do with what he stands for. It's all showbiz. I mean, you know, there was a great line that George H.W. Bush, one of the most excruciatingly dull candidates we've ever had, but he was running against someone even more boring than he was, which was Michael Dukakis. And he said, well, who do you want in your living room for the next 4 years? You want Dukakis or you want me? And, you know, I would not, if Donald Trump knocked at the door, I'd be hesitant to let him in the house. But the reality is that he is so much more interesting than Hillary Clinton or any of the other candidates. You know, he had not the three, but the 17 stooges in the Republican Party who ran, and every one of them was such a snooze. I mean, everybody picked up on Kasich because he occasionally said something vaguely interesting. But, you know, from Chris Christie to Mike Huckabee to every one of those incredible, and even Carly Fiorina, you know, they were excruciating. Trump, at least you have, and I'm talking here not in politics, but in entertainment, right? And, you know, and Trump has mastered the major media. There is just no doubt about it. I mean, I hated watching him. I never watched The Apprentice. Whenever he came on, when I was channel flipping, I went right through him. But I can understand zillions of people watching him. Because he doesn't care. You don't know what he's going to say. We know exactly what Hillary Clinton's going to say and how she's going to say it. And we don't trust her that she means it with Trump. Go ahead, Charlie.
No, I'm sorry, Harvey. You know, you're also underscoring the fact that if Bernie Sanders had been able to capture the Democratic Party nomination, you know, he in his, I mean, again, let's leave aside the fact that you and I are with Bernie Sanders on, you know, just every political and policy element, and that we're turned off by Clinton's corporatist and cautious and whichever way the wind blows, you know, mentality. But Sanders is also interesting and fascinating and strong and surprising and spontaneous and real. I guess that's really,
yes,
that's the word. He's real and not synthetic like the person who did get the Democratic nomination. And
that's exactly,
you know,
right.
we can only rue and wonder at you know, wow, the next 100 days would have been so amazing had it been Sanders versus Trump.
Yes, and I will say here right now, and of course you know, Charlie, and my listeners know that I have spent the last 12 years since the theft of the 2004 election in Ohio really looking into how our elections are conducted. And I will say here without hesitation that in a fairly conducted, hand-counted paper ballot primary campaign between Hillary and Bernie, Bernie would have won. Bernie, I believe that Bernie got more votes than Hillary, and I believe that he was the rightful winner of the Democratic primaries and that he should be the nominee of the party. Now, I did hear him speak in person in Columbus, Ohio, at Ohio State. He talked about 7,000 or 8,000, mostly young, although I must say it was a pretty diverse crowd.
Yeah.
And he was superb. Now, of course, we have a bias, you and me, Charlie. I mean, we're 60-something white Jewish guys who, you know, come from a left tradition. And Bernie is nothing but a slightly older than you and me, but he was I hate to use the word mainstream, but he was a fairly standard and is a fairly standard new left product of the 1960s. And his beliefs, as yours and mine, have not particularly changed since that day and whenever it was in the 1960s when he got radicalized. He just managed to go through the electoral process and become a mayor, a congressman, and a senator. And, you know, God love him. He's the only one who did it. I don't know how,
yeah,
at the age of 74, he made that campaign. I could never have done it. going from town to town and sleeping wherever and speaking day after day, 10, 15 times a day. How he did that is beyond me. I mean, he has some kind of special stamina.
Yes, he does. But obviously he was inspired, by the movement that he created. But Harvey, let me just ask you, I really admire and value the work that you have done since 2004 on election fraud and suppressed votes and stolen results. But the sense I have, and tell me the right numbers because I just don't know them, is that, adding up all the Democratic primary counted votes, that Clinton got in the neighborhood of 16 million and Sanders in the neighborhood of 13 million, about a 3 million gap. And if that's right or close to it, are you really saying that a true count would have more than offset that $3 million counted gap?
Yeah, I am. I mean, Bernie won virtually every precinct where there were hand counted paper ballots. And he lost every precinct where there were machine votes. And you have to remember, Charlie, and we won't go too far on this, but we do need to, since I did say it, there is no accountability on electronic voting machines in this country. The count on the electronic voting machines can be whatever the hell whoever is running the machine wants it to be.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's, by the way, a major danger, since we did bring this up, actually, that Hillary faces in the fall. We have six major swing states, Florida, North Carolina, Ohio, Michigan, Iowa, and Arizona, that are pretty good likelihood that any combination of those states is going to decide the election, right? I mean, in 2004, there were 11 swing states. I can name them. Pretty close to that now.
Yep.
States where we don't know the outcome. We can predict pretty much the outcome in 35 states out of the 50 right now, which underscores what a ridiculous system we have, by the way. But, my vote, if it was going to be counted, which I don't believe it will be properly in Ohio, but if we had a proper vote count in Ohio, my vote would count. Your vote in New York doesn't mean nothing. I mean, we know that New York is going to go for Hillary. Right, and we know that California is going to go for Hillary. If I voted out here, Texas will go for Trump, and then there's this whole big swath of red in the middle of the country, and then the blue states in the east and the west, and then along Lake Michigan, along the Great Lakes, and that's it. And then New England. So, but I don't believe the electronic vote count in the primaries. I do not believe it. If you look at the Republicans, the vote count and the polls, the pre-polls and the exit polls on the Republican side of the primaries are within a couple of percent.
They matched up. Yeah.
That's not the case in the Democrats. The Democratic primaries are all over the map with the polling. And my co-author, Bob Petrakis, who's a political scientist and who really is more reliable than I am on these numbers, basically says there are at least 10 states in the primary process, not caucuses, by the way, which is a whole other world. Oh, the caucuses are insane. I mean, it's completely undemocratic, those caucuses, completely random, what the turnout and the results are. But where they did vote, the discrepancies in at least 10 states are outside of statistical reliability. In other words, they are questionable, to say the least.
Yeah,
and
that the variation is so great that random, fluctuations couldn't possibly have explained it, so that there has to be some underlying common cause, and you're saying, and Harvey, I can't sort of sit here and rebut you, and you may be right, that the only explanation is systemic fraud, by the Democratic Party operatives on behalf of one candidate and against the other.
We know, of course, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, to whom I am not related, by the way. I wish she would change her name just to call herself Debbie Schultz, please. You know, we know that the party apparatus rigged the process.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no
So
I think Bernie was the...
Yeah.
Plus, let's do one simple test. Let's do one let's add up the number of people who came to Hillary's rallies versus those who came to Bernie.
Yeah, I know, but Harvey, come on, nobody, you know, that we know that that's not a test because that goes to the synthetic versus real distinction that we were drawing between their personalities and, you know, what they project as political performers. But I do want to sort of take this in a slightly different direction and to this thing about safe states versus swing states and, you know, my vote in New York, which Clinton has to carry to have any chance of being viable, you know, supposedly being a throwaway or a not essential vote in contrast to yours in the quintessential swing state of Ohio. And what I want to put to you and our listeners today is the idea that the popular vote may end up mattering a great deal on November 9, the day after the election, because I fear, and I think we should all fear, that if the counted vote tally in the Electoral College favors Clinton by, you know, some amount that's not a landslide, that the Trump forces are going to be unleashed and are going to be in the streets the very next day, rioting, bullying, and conducting some sort of putsch to decertify and delegitimize the supposed election results and force you know, the electoral apparatus to crown Trump as the legitimate president. And in my scenario, a possible firewall against that would be a strong popular vote majority for Clinton over Trump. And it's for that reason and that reason alone that I am prepared to, you know, hold my nose and not vote for the Green Party candidate in November, but to vote for the Democratic Party candidate, because I think that that popular vote difference may matter a lot.
Well, that's an interesting and viable position, and I hadn't thought of it. I really have, you know, I was, before the show, we talked and said to people in places like New York, safe states, lock states really is what they are. Should go ahead and vote for Jill Stein, my friend. I am, by way of disclosure, the Secretary of Energy for her Green Shadow Cabinet. And, you know, so I was saying that basically you have a free vote to cast for Jill. And you're making a reasonable point. We should remember that Hitler came to power in Germany with less than 50%. He had about 45% of the vote when he became vice chancellor, and then the chancellor died. Next thing we knew, Adolf was running Germany, and the people who didn't take him seriously had to take him pretty goddamn seriously. So now we have a situation with Trump. I don't think Trump is a Hitler, by the way. I don't think it's a viable comparison. I don't think Trump would ever do death camps. But I do think the comparison to Mussolini is reasonable. And that, you know, he does have followers who would beat people up. We saw that in the primary, process, pretty ugly. He doesn't really care much about what he says. And, you know, Mussolini was a product of the corporations, just like, Trump is. It's interesting. The corporate response to Trump has been very mixed. Of course, the Bush family has come out for Clinton. And many of the major corporations, I'm sure, are very nervous about Trump coming in. Hillary is the perfect corporate candidate. There's no doubt about that. And it's just really going to be a nail biter now to see what happens. I am contending, by the way, that, as I mentioned, these hip swing states, Florida no longer has a Secretary of State. They changed their system after the horrific nightmare of 2000.
Catherine Harris.
North Carolina actually has a Democratic Secretary of State. The other four states, Ohio, Michigan, Iowa, Arizona, they all have Republican governors or Republican Secretaries of State. And I will tell you without hesitation that if it comes down on election night to a close call where Ohio will have the decisive vote as it did in 2004. It will be the choice of John Kasich and John Huston, the Secretary of State, as to who's going to win. Now, you know, Kasich has had a really bitter feud with Trump, and I expect at some point in the campaign Trump will come to Kasich and make no kind of deal. One thing about Kasich, he is anti-choice, and, you know, does have this usual religious belief about killing fetuses. And, you know, they can justify anything when they think they're saving babies. And secondly, probably even more important, his buddy Ted, Rob Portman is running for Senate against the former Democratic governor Ted Strickland. It's a reasonably close race, and they're not going to let that Senate seat go. So at the risk of sounding conspiratorial, although, believe me, just because there's a conspiracy theory doesn't mean there's not a conspiracy. There is the clear and present power in the hands of the Secretary of State of these states with the Republican governors to flip the election however they want. Now, the Democrats can do it, too, and will do it. There's no doubt about it. But they don't control these six states.
Yeah.
And these are the ones that are pretty clearly going to decide the election, as far as I can tell.
Yeah. So, Harvey, let me ask you about the Ohio Senate race, and this might be a good pivot back to carbon tax and climate and fossil fuels. There's this North Carolina plutocrat named Jay Faison, F-A-I-S-O-N, some, you know, wealthy guy who presents himself and has gotten slavish coverage in the national media, including the New York Times, as a Republican businessman with a climate conscience. And he has created some fund, I forget what it's called, like Clean Energy Partners, or that's not quite it, and I'm sorry, I'm not recalling it, to support Republican candidates, you know, down-market House and Senate candidates this fall, who he says are ready to and committed to positive action on climate. And he is two of the candidates that Jay Faison is poised to pour money into their campaigns. Well, one is Kelly Ayotte, Republican senator from New Hampshire, and the other is, as you mentioned, Rob Portman in your state of Ohio. The weird thing about Jay Faison is that he is not a big friend of renewables. He's pro-nuclear. He's pro-hydroelectricity, and we really have pretty much run out of, you know, big hydro capacity. And most important to me, he is against the carbon tax, and he gave a speech in Washington 6 months ago where he just totally misspoke or, you know, evinced a lack of understanding of what a carbon tax does, saying, well, we don't need more top-down regulations, and that's why I'm against the carbon tax, which makes no sense because the carbon tax is the ultimate non-regulatory mechanism for incentivizing every actor in our economy to get off of fossil fuels ASAP. So sorry for that, like, long, you know, prelude, but I want to ask you, is Jay Faison money in evidence in the Rob Portman Ohio Senate reelection campaign?
Well, don't have a specific answer for that, but I will say that Ted Strickland, his opponent, is no friend of renewables either. And, you know, we are now, let's segue over here. We are now in what's turning out to be an all-out war against renewable energy being led by the New York Times, for God's sakes. I mean, they have written and published, and I just published an article at ecowatch.com, which I sent you, Charlie. But the Times has been really assaulting renewable energy. It was the second piece after the one I responded to. The one I responded to was written by Eduardo Porter, and then there's a woman wrote this next one about how, oh, gee, solar is not paying so well anymore, and then she went through a whole litany of legislation that's been passed against renewables, never pointing out that the sponsors of this legislation are fossil fuel and nuclear companies. You know, it's sort of like a force of some kind of action of that nature that suddenly nationwide, all the state legislatures are passing anti-solar bills, and that seems to be just come with the territory And she has an article in the New York Times saying, oh my goodness, solar no longer pays, you know, as if it was a natural phenomenon. Now, your carbon tax here is an essential part of the puzzle. So if you will please explain to us exactly what the carbon tax is. I know it's a non-answer about Portman and Strickland, but I don't really have an answer for you where this guy is directly involved. But Charlie, tell us exactly what is a carbon tax and why do we need it?
A carbon tax taxes the carbon dioxide, you know, climate destabilizing emissions that inevitably result. There's no way around it from burning coal, petroleum or oil, and so-called natural gas or methane. And it does this not by tacking some sort of surcharge onto, you know, every fuel or every product that we buy, because there's energy embodied in essentially every product. You know, if you buy bottled water at a store, you're buying, in effect, a certain amount of fossil fuels, which had to go into, you know, pulling the water out of the ground and making the plastic bottles and putting the water in the bottle and trucking it to the store and keeping it, you know, on and on. It doesn't do that. Instead, the carbon tax is levied upstream, you know, that's a metaphor, at the place where the coal or oil or gas is taken out of the ground, or where it's imported into the United States. And, you know, to get past the wonky, you know, recitation, a carbon tax is a way of internalizing, I guess it's also wonky, the climate damage, the cost of the climate damage from burning fossil fuels. Instead of externalizing it into the environment, it internalizes it into the price of the fossil fuel and thereby creates more of a level playing field that makes it easier and more viable for solar and wind and other renewables and energy efficiency and conservation and mindful ways of living and being on this earth to compete against artificially cheap fossil fuels. So it's really a bedrock idea, and it ought to be persuasive to the left because it does embody making the polluter pay. It ought to be, and in a different kind of society, might be palatable and attractive to people on the right because it avoids complex and opaque regulations and uses prices as an incentive. And I guess to be, you know, straight with you, Harvey, it does accept a capitalist or neoliberal framework. And it ought to be acceptable for all of us who are concerned about economic inequality, because the rich use much more fossil fuels than the poor. And so taxing fossil fuels upstream, as a carbon tax does, is a way to take money out of the pockets of the rich and put it into the pockets of the middle class and the poor. But more important than any of that, and I do a lot of modeling about how fast the carbon tax would drive down emissions, it's just, you know, astounding. If we had a carbon tax that ramped up to triple digits, you know, 15 years from now, or say in 2030, so that it was $100 per ton of carbon dioxide or more, and I know that that's abstract, we can, you know, translate that later, that alone would reduce emissions by about a third within a decade. We would get from, you know, 5 billion metric tons of carbon dioxide a year down to a little bit more than 3 billion, which would be amazing in itself. It would be a lodestar for the rest of the world, and a U.S. carbon tax could translate easily and seamlessly to every other country in the world. The great thing about a carbon tax at a national level is that the revenues are not, you know, collected by other countries or the United Nations or whatnot. It's collected by the country itself. So each country has sovereign control over its carbon tax revenues and can use them in any way that it sees fit.
So is there a country in the world that has a carbon tax?
You know, the best example is British Columbia, which is not a country, obviously. It's the third largest province in Canada, and they've had a carbon tax for 8 years. And it actually kind of shows us two things. You know, one is that a rise in carbon tax drives down emissions, because the British Columbia carbon tax did that in its first 4 years. But it also shows that the carbon tax has to keep going up, because the BC carbon tax has not gone up in 4 years, and now their emissions are kind of back on a rising trajectory like most of the rest of Canada. Now, I didn't mention Northern Europe, you know, the social democracies in Northern Europe, like Sweden, Germany, Denmark, Netherlands, that are so progressive across the board, because they have had taxes on energy, especially, you know, gasoline and diesel fuels for automobiles and trucks, for decades, as part of a conscious policy to not only reduce automobile dependence and oil dependence, but also to ensure the viability of their cities, which now, you know, it's not as if Amsterdam or Copenhagen, you know, in the Middle Ages had millions of people riding bicycles. In fact, their bicycling had gone way down in the 60s and early 70s, but then at that point they made a conscious decision to tax, you know, gasoline and diesel fuel, and some of those taxes have now been extended to other fossil fuels, but they don't call them carbon taxes, which is too bad. And they're a little bit of a patchwork. But the principle has been validated by empirical evidence that carbon taxes, whether they're patchwork or economy-wide, they do the job of driving down carbon emissions.
So what countries in Northern Europe do have this? You're saying that that Norway and Denmark maybe and Netherlands...
Sweden especially, you know, I mean, none of them have a complete comprehensive economy-wide carbon tax. For example, Sweden, you know, has a stiff carbon tax on coal and some petroleum fuels, but not on petroleum fuels and methane that are used in industry. You know, so they kind of make it hard for carbon tax proponents like me to, you know, point to them and say, hey, you know, here's our example. But the bottom line is that Europe uses half as much energy and half as much fossil fuels per capita as the United States. And it's not simply because, oh, we are a spread out country. You know, we're not really that spread out. The United States is not Montana. It's not Wyoming. It's mostly metropolitan areas like your Columbus, Ohio, or my New York City, New York. But rather, those countries have a different organization of their energy systems that they have chosen in a conscious way. And maybe, by the way, this is a good time to mention, since you brought up the New York Times earlier, that Germany, for maybe 20 years, has had an energy transformation that they call the Energiewende. My German pronunciation is awful, but it really means energy makeover or energy transformation, that does include high fossil fuel prices, but more than anything, it is based on community control and community organization of renewable energy. And it's this program that has enabled Germany, I'm stealing your thunder, Harvey, the leader in Solartopia, because, you know, Germany is phasing out its nuclear plants rapidly. And in the face of that, they have managed to cap and reduce CO2 emissions. And there's, you know, quibbling year to year about how fast it's going down or even whether it's going down. Germany is now a net exporter of electricity to just about all of its neighbors, including France. And so some of their CO2 numbers have crept up. But the long-term trend in Germany is that renewables are now a third of German electricity. Fossil fuels outside of the electricity sector, usage is pretty much flat. And as soon as that nuclear phase-out has been, you know, kind of fully absorbed and planned for, Germany is going to be seen numerically as the world leader in getting off of carbon dioxide and fossil fuels. And yet, The New York Times just beats the drum shamelessly and relentlessly about problems in Germany transitioning away from fossil fuels. And that's just not the truth. And why the New York Times feels the need to be so cautious and negative about renewable energy in Germany as well as in the United States is something that I'm bewildered by.
Well, we're talking with Charles Komenoff, one of the world's leaders in the carbon tax movement and certainly one of the great experts for decades on the entire energy picture. Let's take this one head on. We keep reading and hearing from the apologists for nuclear power and fossil fuels that the transition in Germany away from fossil fuels and nuclear power is causing a rise in carbon emissions. Can you talk directly to that, Charlie?
You know, just that the numbers don't bear that out. You know, the German economy is growing. You know, renewables have been on such a boom in Germany, especially solar photovoltaics, that the world owes has a big debt of gratitude to pay to Germany for priming the pump that has caused photovoltaic factories, you know, in China to expand to meet German demand and drive down the cost curve for solar on homes and in businesses and even at utility scale all over the world in the United States. And that is largely because of a conscious social and environmental policy in Germany to move its energy system away from fossil fuels and nuclear power toward renewable energy.
So when these shills go out and say that the energy wind has caused a rise in carbon emissions, are they just flat out lying? Is this like the primary results between Bernie and Hillary here? I mean, what's the real statistic truth?
Yeah, it's just flat out false. And you know, maybe while we're talking, I can get some numbers up on the screen. But you know, any you know, you can take 1990, 2000, 05, 2010, any you know point of departure, and compare 2015. And the total German use of fossil fuels and resulting CO2 emissions is down significantly, and that's even as they have cut their nuclear output, their nuclear power output by, and I'm sorry I don't have the numbers, but somewhere between a third and a half. And it's that, you know, Harvey, I was kind of skeptical, I have to admit. I was, you know, 10 years ago probably where the New York Times is now, in thinking that you couldn't simultaneously, you know, that you couldn't do Solartopia. You couldn't simultaneously phase out existing nukes and phase out existing fossil fuel use and run a modern economy. Germany has proven that wrong.
Well, you know what, Charlie? I'm going to ask you, beg you, to write an article specifically to that point, and I will get it to EcoWatch, because we are inundated. Every article I read about this, one of these industry pushers, including the New York Times, says that this transition is causing fossil fuel use and carbon emissions to go up. And if you're saying that's not true, then we need to have your article out there saying it's not true, because I have been unable to cite, and I want to rebut the second piece from the New York Times, you know, saying, oh, isn't it odd that solar is no longer paying, completely ignoring the source of all the anti-solar legislation. But we need to have this statement out there showing that fossil fuel emissions are going down in Germany, because the opposite is being spoken all over the all over the internet.
Yeah. And the exciting thing about the Energiewende in Germany is that the wind and solar installations are, by and large, community controlled, owned, and driven. And so Germany does not suffer the NIMBY, you know, not in my backyard, resentment and obstruction that is in far too many places in this country. And that, you know, for example, has for 14 years prevented the giant and, you know, precedent shattering, if it could be built, Cape Wind project, you know, from putting, you know, 100 or 150, I forget the exact number, you know, large industrial scale, let's be honest, wind turbines in Nantucket Sound, you know, far off from shore and in ways that would not damage the aquatic environment, and that could be generating, you know, huge amounts of commercial and viable and economic electricity. So, you know, Germany is pioneering not just technology, but a new form of social organization that is not just compatible with renewable energy. It's really the template for it. It's the way to do it.
Charlie, you've got to say that. You have to put that into your article, please. I'm commissioning you to write this article. The check is in the mail. But, you know, because I just said exactly that. This Eduardo Porter piece in the New York Times, which is pure psychosis. I mean, you read this thing, it's Orwellian twisting of the language to blame a rise in carbon emissions on the glut, this is his term, the glut of renewable power that's come from Germany, as if too much cheap, safe, clean, reliable electricity is a curse on the planet because... I hesitate to paraphrase the article.
It's hard to remember what it said because we can't connect the dots in any logical fashion.
Well, I'll tell you exactly what he said. I read it six times. Let me tell you exactly what he said, Joey. He said that we have to have clean, and this is, you know, clean, non-carbon emitting nuclear power, but because that 24/7. That's what fights climate change. But because renewables have come online, they are driving nuclear power off the grid, and because they don't produce electricity, you know, at night and when the wind doesn't blow, therefore, their renewables have to be the gap that's got between those periodic voids when we don't get renewable and the 100% time that we get nuclear. That when we lose the nuclear, but we have the renewables, that gap has to be filled with carbon emitting coal, oil, and gas. And that's what he said, basically, as best I can paraphrase it. The guy is, you know, it's the most, one of the most dishonest pieces of writing I've ever encountered.
But there was one thing in Porter's article, and I don't have it in front of me, that enlightened me, and I want to sort of, you know, run it to our listeners. He explained, and, you know, I hope he's right about this, that that during times when there's more than enough renewables, you know, wind and sunlight, to power the grid or large amounts of it, that the nukes, because they can't be ramped up and down quickly, and of course that's not the fault of solar or wind or the grid, that's something inherent in the way nuclear power plants, you know, have been designed, that the nukes have to be running all the time or much of the time, and so they have to pay, the nuclear operators and owners have to pay the wind and solar operators a fee to take themselves, the wind and the solar, offline or off the grid so that the nukes can be online and on the grid and be able to run during those hours of the day when their output might be needed. And so that is part of what is driving the nuclear operators bankrupt, that they have to, you know, pay off the solar and wind providers as to take themselves off so that the nuclear plants can be on. And I guess that has a certain logic. I guess I kind of believe it. You know, but rather than look at that as or frame that as there being too much solar and wind, let's frame it as nuclear power plants being a rigid dinosaur technology.
Absolutely correct. You know, and I want to credit one of my great heroes and idols, Robin Williams. He had a line. It was very funny. He was pretending to be a fundamentalist preacher, you know, a televangelist. Yes, the guy's doing a good swimming pitch. Here he stops, and this is Robin Williams saying, the word audit does not appear in the Bible. and in Eduardo Porter's piece, the word battery does not appear. There is no mention of the massive push, you know, led by Elon Musk and so many others, to fill this periodicity of renewables with battery technology. The term battery, by the way, was coined by Benjamin Franklin. You know, when he discovered electricity, Franklin didn't just discover electricity. He codified it. He measured it. He quantified various aspects of it, and he came up with the word battery. And you know, batteries are the game changer. There will be no more periodicity in, say, 5 years once these big batteries are available to people who have solar panels and windmills and other things where, you know, to fill in that gap. And then nuclear is really over.
Well, Harvey, we've only got, you know, 8 or 9 minutes left. Maybe we can bring it back to a little bit about where we started and invoke a victory of sorts or progress that we can credit to Senator Bernie Sanders and his campaign and the, you know, the millions
too.
Of people who supported. Well, and here I'm referring to language that almost made it into the Democratic Party platform on carbon taxes. And let me read to our listeners. It's just maybe like 30 words. The Bill McKibben language for a carbon tax. And it here it is. Carbon and other greenhouse gases should be taxed at a rate high enough to spur the transition away from fossil fuels, consistent with the temperature goals agreed to in Paris in 2015. And first of all, you can't, you know, in one sentence get a more, you know, comprehensive and powerful version or statement of a climate or carbon tax platform, at least in my book. And of course, with somebody of the skill of Bill McKibben doing your wordsmithing, it's going to be that quality. But more important is that, you know, Bill McKibben, the great environmental writer and now organizer and leader, who, you know, founded and is still the North Star for 350.org, it was only due to the Sanders campaign that Bill has come on board the carbon tax cause and in a big, explicit way. And it was the Sanders campaign that all through last fall and the winter and spring stressed the need for a carbon pollution tax in addition to reinvesting in America's infrastructure. And, you know, retraining and retooling the coal miners and oil field workers who are going to, you know, lose their jobs as we transition away from fossil fuels. But Bernie was full-throated and unapologetic about calling for a carbon pollution tax and doing it in a way that kind of broke the idea or shattered the idea that you can't, in a major political campaign in the United States, call for taxing carbon emissions. He did. He got support for it. He got credit for leveling with the American people. And now, you know, Bill McKibben, a fellow Vermonter, along with Bernie, is fully on board with a carbon tax. And that's important. That means that the you know, the grassroots environmental movement that Bill symbolizes and spearheads is coming into the carbon tax camp, or that the camps, you know, are meeting, and that in addition to stopping fracking and stopping fossil fuel development and divesting, that all of this energy can come on board with a carbon tax. And I think that's really significant.
Well, great. That's good. But the language did not make it into the Democratic Party platform?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I slid over that. It failed 7-6.
Oh,
that's
my God.
Close.
All right. Well,
Harvey, what did get in was instead of a sentence, it was a paragraph, and it called for a carbon price instead of a carbon tax. And yeah, it's weasel words, but it is something, and it's something to build on. And I think it's just another instance or another example of how, assuming that there is a Democratic victory, you know, for the White House in November, we have to raise the stakes and be, you know, in the streets and in the suites more than ever, and not let up as some of us did in 2009, and make sure that a carbon tax and all the other elements of a true progressive agenda are put in front of Madam President each and every day.
Well, with Charlie Komanoff here, Charlie, this has actually been one of my favorite shows. It's been spectacular. My phone's with us all the time. You are a fantastic guest. I am going to beg you to write this article, and you got to tell me if you don't, because I will. somebody, if you don't, you're the one to write it, but somebody has to point out that all this, we are hearing repeatedly, time and again, that carbon emissions have gone up in Germany because of the energy window. And
yeah, Harvey, I will do it. And the other piece of good news is that two of the, spearheads of the Energiewende, the German energy makeover, they've written a book. I forget the title, but it's, you know, something like the Germany's energy transition. And they are coming to the U.S. this fall on a speaking tour. I'm supposed to be helping them, you know, get venues in New York. I will connect them with you, and, you know, let's make this a big pushback and make sure that Eduardo Porter, the Times columnist, who, you know, like most of the people at the paper, he's a nice guy. He's just got the blinkers on. Let's get him writing about the Marc Jacobson, 100% wind, water, and sunlight scenarios instead of these hand-wringing pieces of why solar can't do the job.
Well, I got to tell you, you know, we worked with Matt Wald all those years, and we all thought he was a nice guy, and then he went and worked for, now he's with the Nuclear Energy Institute.
I know.
You know, that was a shock. I have to say that was a shock. I did not.
Yeah, and to me, probably more than you, Harvey, because I knew him pretty well.
Yeah, and now Eduardo Porter is probably heading the same direction. But you need to look at this next piece that was in the Times, and let me know when you're going to write this article. I will push the hell out of it. Charlie, you've been a spectacular guest. Let's talk very quickly about bicycles. How big an impact has bicycle? You know, because of what happened in New York and a lot of work you did, there are now these bicycle rental things in cities all over the country, including Ann Arbor, Michigan, and Columbus, Ohio. There are the equivalent of city bikes there. It's spectacular. I never thought they could make a go of renting bicycles like that in Columbus, Ohio, but you can. And how big of a deal is it continuing to be in New York, this bicycle deal?
It's a huge deal in New York. I think they're now up to about 60,000 trips a day on these bike share bikes. Don't give me a penny's worth of credit for that. That goes to, you know, the whole generation of bike activists that came after me. And I think we have to do a shout out to Mike Bloomberg, you know, who spoke at the Democratic Convention last night. And, you know, for all his flaws, and they are legion, he at least, had a vision of taking the Paris Bike Share program, bringing it to New York, and he didn't let the doubters and the backbiters deter him. He stuck it out, and now it's a fixture.
Well, thank you, Charlie. You've been spectacular. It's one of my favorite shows. Thanks to the crew in New York. Charlie, when I put you out, is it L-I-E or Charles?
Either way, it's all good, Harvey.
Well, I'm going to stick with Charlie. Thank you so much. Thank you, crew in New York. We'll see you next week.
Garden was lost, and so we had